And you're tuned to WOWDLP, Tacoma Park.
Good morning. You're tuned to WOWDLP, Tacoma Park, 94.3 on your FM dial. I'm Sheila Blake, and this is the Artist Experience Radio Show. We opened with Vivaldi's Four Seasons, and that was summer. The Baroque band was Il Giardino Armonica.
Wow, that was something. Do you remember when the early music season started 50 years ago, they couldn't even tune their instruments. But the development of Baroque style in the last couple of decades is just astounding.
Wow. This is the Artist Experience Radio Show, and that was Peter. Peter Blake, my husband. Tom, my usual radio partner, is on vacation in Greece, hoping to do some sketches and preparations for paintings. We have an Artist Experience page on Facebook, which we put images of the things we're talking about. It's also a place we'd love our listeners to give us ideas and feedback. Please look at it if you can while you're listening. Especially today, it will be really helpful. You can stream this program at tacomaradio.org, and we're also putting podcasts of this show on my website, sheilablake.com, and on artistexperience.com, so you can listen anytime. And the podcast can also be found on iTunes. Last week, we did a show on landscape art about John Ruskin. And he was the great everything, philanthropist, purveyor of art. And he had ideas about art, which are good and bad. So this is going to be, we're going to continue with that. There's a show at the National Gallery of Art, still on the American Pre-Raphaelites. And we're going to talk about why look at landscape art. Why look at art at all? The contributions of landscape painting in the history of art, and also how to go about drawing landscapes, tips and lessons for all of us. There's a lot to talk about, and especially for you listeners who like the idea of sketching while on vacation. John Ruskin said that the best way to experience the outdoors is to draw, to look closely, to spend time drawing what you see. And I agree. Except who does that now? You all have cameras on your phones, and it's so easy to take that picture, which you probably never look at again. But, of course, it's an entirely different experience to draw. Once you've drawn something, you will possess it. It's yours in a way that you will only know if you've done it. I possess half my neighborhood. The problem with drawing is it takes time, and if you have traveling companions, you probably won't want to wait for you. But maybe they have things that they want to do on their own, too. But it might mean separating from the pack, which is sometimes difficult. I thought it would, though, be important to take this hour to give you some thoughts on landscape painting and how to proceed. And my husband is Peter with me in the studio, as I said, and he's going to also have some contributions of poetry.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me.
So we've decided to divide the show in two parts. The first half, why would you want to look at and draw landscapes? In the second half, how to go about it. So when I was 8 years old, we got a television set. Every Saturday morning, John Nagy, who was an art guru with a goatee, he would appear in his program called You Are an Artist. In 1947, at that time, this was the ninth printing of his book by the same name, and it was the longest-run program of anything on NBC. And I'm going to quote what they say in the book. He was evangelical in his never-flagging patience with which he tears through the veil of mystery about the subject of art to reveal the artist shining in everyone. His belief was rooted in a fundamental concept of human creativeness in its revelation to the rest of the universe. I love this show. I still have my book. Every Saturday, I would sit in front of the TV with my John Nagy drawing kit and follow his instructions. He taught me how to draw the four basic forms, cube, ball, cone, and cylinder, and more thrillingly, how to shade in order to give the illusion of depth, the third dimension. Then he taught us to let the paper make the snow in the snowscape. Boy, did I love this. When I think back, he didn't tell you to look. He told you what you might expect to see, even though you're in front of the TV set. And there's a lesson in this. Even though I am completely involved in the idea of close observation, really looking, there's a part of art training that you look for what you can expect to see. My next art teacher was a real person called Mr. Popoff, and he was kind enough to tolerate four teenagers. We would come every Saturday morning, and he would constantly remind us, don't do it unless you see it. There's a drawing by Leonardo da Vinci dated August 5th, 1493. It's drawn in great detail with a quill pen and walnut ink, and it's the Valley of the Arno. When he was living with his family, da Vinci explored the hills and collected everything, small flowers, animals, leaves, woods. He was curious about everything. This is the first known landscape without human figures and without symbolism. It was just drawn to be what it is. And Leonardo's technique demonstrates really all you need to know about the classical representational landscape. It shows you how to make a convincing three-dimensional landscape. In the Da Vinci, you can see how the paper makes the atmospheric light, just like in John Nagy's picture with the snow. The pen suggests leaves, branches, landforms, reflections on the surface of the water, and his understanding of perspective, how all these work together to show the foreground of boulders, the middle ground with the boats on the water, and the background with the mountains receding to create a deep space. It's important to have a grasp of perspective to understand that lines leading away diminish to a point on the horizon. And then you need to understand that in landscape, things recede in the atmosphere, that the closer things appear, the higher the contrast, which means the greater the range between black and white. And as the terrain recedes, the contrasts get less and less. The values get closer to a middle gray, till the lights and darks are almost indistinguishable at gray at the horizon. Once you know these rules, you know what to look for in nature.
Now, ever since our last show on the American landscapes in the exhibition called American Pre-Raphaelites, you and I have been talking, trying to locate and identify and describe in words what pleasures there are in looking at landscape paintings and what's missing.
And about the development of landscape painting and its place today.
So we're so tempted to try and describe what makes a good painting, and we'll be doing that, but ultimately it's impossible to say what makes a painting because they go past words, past telling. Their function is to burn. There's a philosophy book by John Dewey with a title that's the namesake of our show, Artist's Experience. I can recommend it highly. It's the prime source of our aesthetic philosophy here. And, of course, there are thousands of other attempts to describe, analyze, and celebrate the experience of art. We'll do our part today with a concentration on landscapes. So, are landscapes simply pretty pictures of vacation spots? Of course, no. There's something at stake. There's something at stake for both amateurs and the great ones. A vision, an experience that can bridge the duality and bring us the experience of a real world that is also a reconciled, unified real world. One of the finest statements about all art is from Coleridge. Imagination, that is, painting, reveals itself in the balance or reconciliation of opposite or discordant qualities. It's that coming into balance from an initial state of disequilibrium that provides the primary experience of art. The shooting of the gulf from our normal scattered state to one of balance. That's the basis of rhythm, according to John Dewey. And at the most basic level, what could be more discordant, dualistic, and contradictory than the effort to create on a flat surface a unified world that we experience as whole and full, and, at least in that instant, as real. And, of course, by real we don't mean simple point-to-point correspondence of the image and the scene. It's not a duplication or photographic imitation. Reality, like with a capital R. We're talking about reality as an experience in the body of the viewer. How you can look into the painting and move your attention along a path, over a barrier, into the openings. How you can experience the sprung motion of forms that are balanced. And by balanced, I mean, imagine an abstract painting of beams jutting out. How you can feel them about to move, about to tip. And in a more traditional landscape, the same experience, maybe trees and rocks on a mountain, balanced, able to move, not yet moving. So the 19th century was the century of landscape painting and the century of a new kind of painting, plein air. It might have been kicked off in the 18th century by an English writer, Edmund Burke, who attempted to describe the sublime and the beautiful. That was the title of his book. Here's the sort of thing, the sublime and the beautiful, from Wordsworth. So a little section of the poem, The Prelude. The immeasurable height of woods decaying, never to be decayed. The stationary blasts of waterfalls. And in the narrow rent at every turn, winds thwarting winds, bewildered and forlorn. The torrents shooting from the clear blue sky, the rocks that muttered close upon our ears, black drizzling crags that spake by the wayside as if a voice were in them, the sick sight and giddy prospect of the raving stream, the unfettered clouds and region of the heavens, tumult and peace, the darkness and the light.
Sure. Wonderful.
In a painting.
That's great.
So that's the sublime and the beautiful, according to Burke. And Burke identified the elements in a painting of the sublime as indistinctness and darkness, enormous depth, vertical movement up off the canvas, enormous expanse extending beyond the frame right and left. And this created an awareness of one's own significance, insignificance, which translated into identification with the image. That's what we were talking about before, the entering into the image, followed by a return to awareness of the painting.
Yeah, you know, these paintings, I think probably most of us have seen them, by Caspar David Friedrich and Thomas Cole, Frederick Church, which are known as the Hudson River School paintings. They have some of these at the American Museum of Art at the Smithsonian.
Yeah, they do. Huge mm-hmm. paintings. These paintings were a terrific sensation for a while in their day, but at some point the faith necessary to make them come alive in your imagination began to fade. There's a contradiction at the heart of these paintings, and in all paintings, always lurking there, the contradiction between experiencing the subject as real and the actual reality of it, of being a painting. At first, the jaw-dropping reality of Cole's and Church's paintings overrode the viewer's resistance, and people would look with amazement into the vast spaces pictured, the rainbows, the waterfalls, the spiritual light piercing through the clouds. Eventually, though, the contradiction became more and more obvious. That is, the artifice became more visible and the illusion less real. And new painters strove to come up with the new realization that would allow something, at last, something real. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing is going to happen over and over again. What is real to one generation is revealed to be artifice, and new paths to reality need to be discovered. Luckily, in the Romantic era, we were awash in pantheistic and romantic ideas and hopes. One approach was taken by the Americans of the Pre-Raphaelite movement. Maybe one could find a purer approach with absolute fidelity to nature. The artist would be an intermediary, like a priest, like an American Adam, who would reveal the identity and wondrous powers of creation in nature.
Oh, Peter, that was really good.
I was just thinking that if we have out there naturalists, bird watchers, you should go see that show.
That's good. Well, John Ruskin's manifesto commands pure observation and scientific knowledge. He said that affection and discord, fretfulness and quietness, feebleness and firmness, luxury and purity, pride and modesty, and all other such habits and every conceivable modification and mingling of them may be illustrated with mathematical exactness by conditions of line and color. I think that might be an overstatement, but it just can't be altogether true. In the last show, we said that when a pupil of Ruskin's followed Ruskin's teaching to the letter, he produced a landscape that he showed Ruskin, and Ruskin was horrified because the painting lacked what's at the heart of painting: awe, love. But Ruskin did teach us something: to get outside and paint. And I admire his fidelity to nature and truth. But then why did all these painters need to go to dramatic places in the landscape show at the, you know, the one we're talking about, the National Gallery? Most of the landscape paintings were done in the Adirondacks, in the Berkshires, or in the softer hills of the Catskills. So if all that's required to arrive at the sublime is to faithfully record some scene, why didn't they just go out in their backyard?
Yeah, that was the position taken by Thoreau and Emily Dickinson. And, well, in the American Pre-Raphaelite show, there were a few backyard paintings of a bird's nest, fence post, Queen Anne's lace, and such. Here's Emily Dickinson on the subject. To make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee. One clover and a bee, and reverie. The reverie alone will do if bees are few.
Oh, boy. So I'm going to talk about the French development. French painters went through a similar kind of transition. They rebelled against the artificial landscapes of Watteau and Fragonard, and they went out of doors into the plein air. Unlike their American contemporaries, they were confident in possessing the legacy of five centuries of European art. So they slowly developed, step by step, a new technique, plein air painting. Corot and Dubigny made new discoveries in color, the way hues change under different lights, how the hues of forms in nature change as light changes. At the time, history painting was the highest class of painting. Originally, that was dominated by religious paintings, and then it was expanded during the Renaissance, the Italian Renaissance, to include themes of mythology, literature, or history, which typically were executed on a really large scale. These were the main genre of European art for centuries. They tell stories. But now, in the 19th century, following in the path of Poussin and Claude Lorrain, artists eager to paint from nature went to Italy. They painted ancient monuments drenched in Mediterranean sunlight, and they gathered to paint and draw directly in the landscape. So even if they continue in the neoclassical aesthetic, they were forced to go outside, and they were exposed to the awesome effects of nature. And in order to fully experience nature, they had to look rather than copy, to feel rather than analyze. The golden age of Dutch painting, which were low-toned, atmospheric paintings, they're beautiful. And in England, J.M.W. Turner, who was a printmaker and a painter and a watercolors, he was just an amazing phenomenon. He appeared making expressive, imaginative landscapes, and his turbulent, often violent marine paintings. He had been championed by John Ruskin, and today is regarded as having elevated landscape painting to an eminence that rivaled history painting. Turner opened the world to the effects of light, and in fact, his late paintings had maybe a couple of lines for masts or sails, and only that tenuous line anchored him to any kind of concrete reality. I think it's fair to say that Turner was the precursor of the Hudson River School and also of the color field painters in the 1950s, like Jules Zelitsky, and especially Mark Rothko, whose brushy blocks of color rise off the walls to arrive at a place between your eye and your spirit. John Constable, the English painter, exhibited his works in 1824 at the Salon de Paris. He drew outdoors but painted in the studio, and he found effects with the brush that imitated the immediacy of his drawings, and he gave it airy brightness to his landscapes. And then younger French artists were entranced by these rural scenes, which moved them to draw their inspiration directly from nature. Natural scenes became the subjects of their paintings rather than just backdrops to dramatic events. So during the revolutions of 1848, the artists gathered at Barbizon to follow Constable's ideas. Theodore Rousseau, Millet, Daubigny, they were the leaders. Their paintings are full of mood, which are created by dark forms of trees and ground, punctuated by patches of light coming through the trees or reflected on the water. During the late 1860s, the Barbizon painters attracted the attention of a younger generation of French artists studying in Paris. Several of these artists visited Fontainebleau Forest to paint, including Claude Monet, Renoir, Sisley, and Bazille. In the 1870s, these artists and others developed the art movement called Impressionism and practiced plein air painting in order to research the effects of light with paint. Each artist has his own expression, but with Cézanne, that became a challenge to rebuild nature with paint. Cézanne taught himself and us to see in a new way. And now I have to talk about Van Gogh, the man who put his life on the line for us so we could live and breathe his paintings. Van Gogh had about 10 years of creating 2,100 paintings and drawings, his gift to the world. But before that, he had educated himself. He had gone to art school. He also educated himself by drawing a lot and by studying prints and learning perspective and color theory, so that by the time he started to paint, he really knew what to do. What I'm making a case for is that landscape painting freed artists to explore and experiment with effects of light, with expanded space, with not having to represent anything, where the awesomeness of nature was what dominated, and the subject became secondary, or the narrative became secondary, and then it just became intrusive. Monet did a series of paintings all with the same motif and composition, a series of haystacks, a series of the Rouen Cathedral, each painted at a specific time of day and season and weather, each one showing the color changes created by the changes in the illuminating light. He created a lyrical, unthreatening version of the sublime. Peter was talking earlier about the strategies to bridge the contradiction and separation between the two realities, the reality of the subject and the reality of the painting. Think about Monet's water lily paintings with all the elements listed by Edmund Burke in The Sublime and the Beautiful, utilizing an impasto technique, which is, if you look at these paintings, the surface is built up under the paint so that the paint could be scumbled over this surface that livened the paint. And I want to talk about that because, of course, Monet never really talked about painting in the studio, but it shows you the preparation he made for doing what seemed to be the most immediate kind of painting. And so utilizing the technique, he also never let the viewer forget that they were looking at a painting. The sky, the water surface, the reflections of the clouds in the water surface, it's all there. The lily pads and the blossoms, they're floating on the surface. And then you look into the depth, into the water, the shadows, the glints of light on ripples. They all extend beyond the picture frame of these clearly imaged and beautiful jewel-like tones, and yet with paint that is always clearly paint. It's an advanced solution in a sequence of evolving solutions to the challenge of reconciling and harmonizing the conflict between representation and reality.
You know, I remember you telling me that Monet used to have he'd set up his easel in front of the haystack, and he'd paint for an hour, and then the light would change, and an assistant would take the painting away and put in the next one that would be the 4 o'clock painting, uh-huh. And then he'd do the 6 o'clock painting, and he'd come back the next day and pick them up in order and work through them like this until the whole series was done.
Oh, I'm glad I told you this. It's very intelligent of me. Thank you. So the paintings of Barnett Newman and Jules Zelitsky and Mark Rothko are inconceivable without this development. And Turner, too, he was so seminal to this. He opened the possibility that painting could reside somewhere in between the actual scene and the mind. Rothko, Barnett Newman, this place of feeling that's conjured up by the painting, but is received in a place that's more like dreams. Some color or mood or rhythm or all of these that spark something in you, a memory or a longing or a new awareness that you can return to.
Yeah, you can read almost all 20th century abstract paintings as landscapes. This is something you hear first. That's how I've been reading them. And that trick is my gift to you lawyer listeners. Classic 20th century abstract paintings, Pollock, Mark Rothko, Clifford Still, de Kooning, Diebenkorn, present us with a cosmos of like heaven, a detail, or hell, a detail, or perhaps a detail of nature or language or modern commercial city life. A lot of these artists were philosophical. They were working out how to live in civilization. I think that You know, a lot of contemporary art is not. You don't read it as a landscape, but a lot of that, a lot of the classic 20th century, you can.
Mm-hmm. Well, this time in America during the Civil War produced some wonderful landscape painters, and it began to put America on the map as having its own important art. But there followed a development of fantastic landscape painting that, along with the influences from Europe, evolved to make America the center of innovation in modern art. Marston Hartley was an American modernist painter known for his use of volumetric forms, rich colors, and bold lines. Hartley developed his vision by watching the Cubists in Paris. Similar to his contemporaries Arthur Dove and Georgia O'Keeffe, Hartley's depictions of landscapes, figures, and still lifes exude a wondrous reference toward the natural world. And then we come to Edward Hopper. He seemed to just paint what he saw with a kind of deadpan recording. There's a suppression of any kind of heroics, no dramatic brushstrokes, just amazing composition, perfect light and shadow. And with that, he used stillness to create a mood that's iconic. And his friend Charles Birchfield, whose paintings are the opposite, his backyards in Ohio or in New York State, they're of the most ordinary places, and he made up a whole language, or arrived at this whole language that takes you to a place that you might never see. But you can hear the crickets and the crows and the sounds of ominous creatures coming to life in the trees and the houses. The whole, not on art, but on life, and the life that he knows and loves best. Birchfield is a mystic, a cryptic painter of transcendental landscapes, trees with telekinetic halos and haunted houses emanating ectoplasmic auras.
Wow. So you're right about the crickets in Birchfield. We're going to take a break now. The music that opened our show was Vivaldi's Summer from the Four Seasons. That was the third movement. We'll play now the opening movement. It starts slow, full of summer, that summer in slow heat with bees and crickets. Then sudden rainstorms, then back to lazing around, and then more rain. So hope you enjoy it.
Welcome back. That music is a wonderful example of a crossover between music and painting and natural experience. And I was thinking about it because a few weeks ago we did a show on Oliver Lee Jackson, whose whole inspiration for painting comes from listening to jazz. And he really wants to make his painting an experience like listening to jazz. And I think listening to this Vivaldi is like experiencing summer, also like experience the summer in paintings. In this second half of the show, we're going to talk about you, the budding artist. Here's how they do it, and here's how you start drawing from nature. I'm going to talk about André Laute. He was a master painter and teacher, and he has a lot to teach about landscapes. He was the antithesis of John Nagy. He was a Frenchman. He was intelligent and knowledgeable and incredibly arrogant. André Laute was from the time that art teachers would insult and humiliate their students in hopes of weeding out the uncommitted to dissuade young people of the idea that painting is a relaxation or a means of livelihood. He couldn't make it in 5 minutes in a classroom. These days, all the students would call their parents on their cell phones, and they'd weep, and the parents would call the department chair, and the chair would call the dean, and everything would break loose. But Laute was insufferable, but he's also very right about things. So he said that a man picks up a brush and the self-deception that mysteriously descends on him prevents him from learning anything. He saw that in 1939, after Van Gogh's death, Van Gogh became a model for a whole generation of budding saints, that hosts of easels covering the countryside, sunshades sprout in every field, the winds and the rain blow to no effect, the easels stand firm, fastened with ropes fixed to the ground with rubble-filled sacks, neither dust not the glare of the sun deters thousands of French people from their touching task of dabbing a paintbrush on a piece of canvas in hopes of creating a masterpiece. Oh. Laute was not satisfied with the Raphael classical tradition. He saw that Cézanne had a mode of expression that was the opposite of Raphael. He sees Renaissance painting as boring, with its false perspective, as opposed to Cézanne's complex perspective. Until Cézanne, the artists were building a facsimile of nature, one that you could imagine yourself in, lying under the trees, following that fork in the road, especially the English painters like Constable and Gainsborough. Each artist has his own expression, but Cézanne took on the challenge of rebuilding nature. André Laute said Cézanne's whole genius consisted in his petite sensation, the faculty for transfiguring the actual through the faithful notation of his hallucinations from nature. I love this. Yeah. It is frenzy alone that drives a craftsman to a poet.
Well, as a teacher, did he have any good advice for beginning artists?
Well, let's get into it. When you're starting to draw, there's so much confusion. There are so many things going on, and how to narrow it down.
You see all the detail, but you've got to start seeing the landscape as a symphony of forms. You've got to see it in the forms, the arrangement of forms.
Mm-hmm. Don't get overwhelmed with detail. I'm going to tell you what André Laute taught, and it's the idea of screens and passages. The screens are the series of shapes that begin in the foreground and diminish to the horizon in the far distance. The sky can be seen as the same way, with the clouds beginning forward and moving back in layers to the horizon. It might help to think of stage sets with flats beginning in the front and successive flats moving in layers that give the illusion on stage of great distance. Those are the screens. The passages take your eye through the space. You can think of paths or roads or breaks in the screen that move you back into the space. This concept is called spatial arabesque. And it's been used by painters through the Renaissance to be able to wander into the landscape. This is a fairly sophisticated idea to grasp at once, but it's helped me enormously to compose my paintings.
Yeah, you learned that from Gabriel Latterman.
I did. Gabriel Latterman was a New York painter, and one time he saw my work on the internet. He must have been trolling the internet because he sure didn't know me, and he wrote to me. And he said, there's something you don't know, and I'm going to teach it to you. And he was awful. He was mean, like Andre Lhote.
Yeah.
But he got my attention. And that was really the most, you know, they say in the universe, when you're ready for your teacher, your teacher will come.
They do say
he
that.
Was at Gabriel Latterman. Yes. So let's talk about drawing. You'll need just a few simple things, a few nice pencils. For fine detail, you want H pencils, hard pencils. For texture and tonal range, you want B pencils. Those are the blacker pencils. And the blacker the pencil, the softer the lead. The 9B pencil will give you a darker mark, but it will also become blunt very quickly. The standard sketching pencil is HB or 2B, and that's really all you need. And you need a sharpener, either a sharp pocket knife and a small sandpaper block or a small sharpener. Those don't use those electric ones. They just eat up the pencils. Or you can use charcoal, which has the advantage of being able to smudge with your finger or a paper smudger. The paper smudger is really useful. Charcoal is messier, but it's also looser. You can cover surfaces really quickly. You can get your ideas down fast. I would prefer charcoal. And you need a pad of paper with a hard back, or a paper with a board with clips. If you use a small pad, you can probably just balance it on your lap or on one chair and sit on another. You want to be comfortable so that you can see the scene you're drawing without any obstruction and no changing your viewpoint. You have to stay in the same place. You'll also need an eraser. I like to have a few kinds. A kneaded eraser, which you can sort of knead and form. You can make points with it. You can make, and it's very good. And a magic eraser. Those are the kind that don't leave a residue of erasers. They also have nice eraser holders. It's like a lead pencil or a pen, and then you can feed a slender eraser stick into it and use it like an erasing pencil. And you'll need artist tape and a 12-inch ruler. So start with a scene that pleases you. Keep it simple. You can use a small device that you look through. It's called a view catcher. They didn't used to have these, and I used to use like a frame without the slide in it. Of course, we don't even have slides now.
No,
but you could hold the rectangle up to the scene and help you sort of compose what you want in your painting or drawing. But now they make this little lightweight tool, and it's really handy. It has four sides that slide in and out and form a square or a rectangle. And you can form a rectangle and look through the hole and scan the landscape to find what you'd like to draw. It's like the viewfinder in a camera, and you can hold it close to your eye or further away and see how much of the scene you want to draw. Think about cropping the image in the same way that you would with a camera. Take your time. Keep it simple. There's so much confusion out there when you look at a landscape. So now, tape some rectangles on your paper. I assume that you'll be using like a 9x12 or 10x14 pad, but you can use a small traveling sketch pad too. About 3 or 4 rectangles are good. Rectangles are good, and that are the same proportions as the view catcher. So this way, you can try 3 or 4 different combinations of compositions, deciding what you want to include without committing just to the first idea. It forces you to experiment, look closer in, to the left, further away, until you find the right frame for your picture. You can transfer these proportions to your paper. Say you are viewing the rectangle as a 2-inch by 3-inch in your viewfinder. You can multiply that by 2 and draw a 4-inch by 6-inch rectangle, or multiply it by 4 and draw an 8 by 12-inch rectangle on your paper. You'd be amazed how hard it is to get that across, how important it is to keep your proportions right.
To the students, you mean?
Yes, to the students.
Well, this is a real workshop here.
I hope so. So once you find the exact frame for your painter, you can transfer these proportions to your paper. A good thing is to use artist tape to frame the drawing. So once you've drawn the lines, tape those lines. And that defines your edges. And it also makes a clean edge of a finished drawing. So when you pull the tape off, it looks very spiffy. It looks good. So I know that you're going to have to curb the impulse to get right to the finished drawing. But trust me, it's really important to prepare.
So what was that you were talking about earlier about Andre Lotz's idea about screens?
Okay, well, in order to depict the space, here's an important idea. The closer the things are to you, the more distinct the detail and the higher the contrast. Contrast meaning between dark and light.
Yeah.
So as things recede, you see less detail, you see less contrast, until you arrive at the long distance, which is where the sky meets the land. So with the idea of screens and passages, you will try to see these, the foreground, the middle ground, and the background as somewhat distinct shapes. Another approach to drawing is to decide on a simple close-up composition. Again, use the slide frame and tape some rectangles. Start with a pencil or charcoal thumbnail sketches. Choose a time of day, early morning or late afternoon, when the shadows are strongest. The shadows are as important a part of your composition as the objects themselves. The shadows are what tie things together. All of these steps are important. And if you stay with even the most preliminary sketches, you'll be learning a lot. Don't rush too much to get to a finished drawing or detail. Sometimes the simplest drawings are the most satisfying.
Yeah, we've got some drawings from Cezanne's small sketchbook on the Facebook page, and they're really simple. But even to my untrained eye, they're very beautiful.
Yeah, they sure are. And really, these drawings are pencil drawings in his small sketchbook. And they tell you so much with so little. So your initial composition is the most important part. And of course, if you go on to do a more detailed drawing, you might decide to change things and move things around. But you'll be starting from a really solid place. So many landscape painters use a device called a perspective frame. Now, you don't need to do this, but I want to introduce this idea. A perspective frame, it's known that Van Gogh hauled his perspective frame along with his easel and his paint box into the fields near Arles in the midday sun. Imagine this. It's a frame with glass that you put on a separate easel next to your paper. And on the glass, you've drawn a grid, say a 1 inch by 1 inch. But in France, it was, you know, centimeters, and different mathematical gradation. But on the, so you draw, say, squares on the glass, and then you draw the same squares on your paper, and you draw them lightly. The same grid is on the glass. And then when you're looking through the glass, and you always have to stand in exactly the same spot, you looking through the glass grid, you can transfer the landscape square by square to the drawing or painting. Perspective is so deceptive. And here's how they get to the diminishing space. It's like if you look at a Cézanne or a Van Gogh, sometimes you can see the little perspective. You can see that little grid on their drawings. But that's how they did it. I don't know that just with your eye, without really being aware of the diminishing perspective, you're not going to get things to stand up straight and stop and not recede. So those are some artists that are really good to look at. and then Rembrandt and Cezanne. And there's a contemporary painter called Rackstraw Downs, and you should check him out. He's my age, and he was born in England, but he was educated in the U.S., and he's got it all. When I saw his actual paintings, his paint is kind of flat, it's kind of dead, but the effects of composition in space, while painting the highways of New York, you can't believe the complexity of his paintings and how perfectly organized they are. Like he did one called Under the Hospital Complex at 168th Street. These are spectacular paintings. Now you can imagine standing under a New York highway painting what he can see underneath and beyond. And his paintings are so full of light and complicated perspective. And I promise you that I assumed that he used photographs. A lot of painters use photographs, and there's really nothing wrong with it. But I have seen pictures of him, and he's standing outside like in the barren Texas hills with his French easel and his canvas, and he's using his pencil to measure. Have you seen artists do that? Just the way we were taught to do, the old-fashioned way. And these paintings are fabulous. They really are. Rackstraw Downs.
That's great.
So I think that's, if you have any questions about my little drawing instructions about how to proceed with landscapes, you can write us on our Facebook page. I'd love to try to answer your questions, because these come from me and the difficulties and what I've learned. And I want to thank you all for listening, and good luck with sketching. It's really neat. Okay.